are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, November 28th, 2018. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, professor from the Harvard School of Government, Stephen Walt. On the hell of good intentions, America's foreign policy elite and the decline of U.S. primacy. Meanwhile, revealed yesterday, it turns out, in fact, Manafort's lawyers were briefing Trump's lawyers even after having made a plea deal. Also on the did they or didn't they front, Jerome Corsi pretends he thought up the whole idea of WikiLeaks, passing on emails. And a vote today in the Senate to end our Yemen assault. Meanwhile, Chuck Schumer does it again, folks. This time offers Trump part of his wall in return for nothing. Meanwhile, U.S. creating a border crisis by stalling on asylum applications at the border. And Cory Booker to propose baby bonds. Meanwhile, last night in Mississippi, racist wins, but not as big as she should have. Meanwhile, North Carolina, a racist may not get on the federal judiciary after all. Speaking of North Carolina, it could be 41, folks. It still could be 41. We thought the midterms were over, but the 9th congressional district in North Carolina, where the Republican won by 900 votes, refused to certify the election because of some shenanigans. Unnamed shenanigans. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Forgive me for one moment because I really need to blow my nose. Excuse me.
That's very triggering. A guy just snot rocket right onto my bag today on my way to work. So.
Wow. I'm sorry about that.
When did you do that?
It was not...
I didn't know that you guys had the same route.
No, I was. I didn't mean to. That was an accident.
Snot rocket. All right. See you there. I need the packet ready.
Folks, before we get to today is a big day in my life. Before we get to that, let me remind you that... You spend a third of your life in your sheets. And it's about time for a bedding upgrade. Literally, let me just tell you this. As I was reading this, my first reaction was, God damn it, because I just bought a set of pillows. And I didn't realize we were going to get a $20 off the promotion. I had no idea. What am I talking about? I'm talking about Brooklinen. They were founded in early 2014. They are the fastest growing bedding brand in the world with over 30,000 five-star reviews, 500,000 happy sleepers and counting. Their mission is to make the five-star hotel quality sheets that are affordable and easy to order. And since they believe that sheets should look great in addition to feeling great, they offer over 20 colors and patterns that you can mix and match. I have multiple sets of Brooklinen sheets, pillowcases, and I just went in for the pillows, and I may actually go now with this deal. I may go in with some king size pillowcases as well. Why not? Why not have it all match? That would be new for me. I've spoken about Brooklinen a lot. They give you a couple of different styles of cotton sheets. If you want to be like me, you go with the classic, cool, crisp cotton ones. But they have the more silky types. That's just not what I go for. I like it. I like it rough. Anyways, folks, my Brook linen sheets are the best, most comfortable sheets I've ever slept on. And now it's time for your upgrade. Brooklinen.com is giving an exclusive offer just for my listeners. Get $20 off and free shipping. I've got to get those pillows now. When you use promo code MAJORITY at Brooklinen.com, Brooklinen is so confident in their product that all their sheets, comforters, and towels come with a lifetime warranty. The only way to get $20 off and free shipping is to use the promo code MAJORITY at Brooklinen.com. That's Brooklinen, BROOKLINEN.com. Promo code MAJORITY. Brooklinen, these really are the best sheets ever. I'm telling you. Believe me. Okay, folks. Like I say, today is a very special day for me. It is the anniversary of the day Mike Cernovich provided for me one of the more enjoyable experiences I had had in an extended period of time, and at the same time, essentially took a hammer and smashed his own fingers. That's a metaphor, of course. He didn't really do that, although he may have, for all I know. So let's go back a year to the day. Sometime before November 28th, 2017, we had looked at this video of Mike Cernovich in basically a live audition on InfoWars. This was a show many of you probably don't remember. There was this guy, Alex Jones, and he used to have a big show that people apparently, I don't know if they watch anymore, but when was the last time you heard Alex Jones' name? Talk about the value of deplatforming. Yep. But anyways, here was Alex Jones, and Mike Cernovich was in a big opportunity for him, looking for legit work, and, well, he didn't do so well.
This is an executive order outside of law, just legalizing everybody. But then that was ignored what he really said. But think about the takeaway of this with this mayor, where you can say, okay, and also not welcome, law and order, also not welcome, safe society, also not welcome, a property tax base that isn't being eroded. I mean, these Democrat-run cities are sinking into the mud. And here is Rahm Emanuel demonizing the president, trying to save the economy.
Right, because he has no answers. He has no answer for the violence. He has no leadership. While there, how many people are shot every weekend in Chicago? 30 to 50 people some weekends are shot. Record numbers of murders.
All right,
in
pause
Chicago.
It for 1 second. I want to go back just to just take it to just seconds before Alex Jones tees up the audio from Rahm Emanuel, and instead here's Mike Cernovich, and you can see the anger on Jones.
Into the mud, and here is Rahm Emanuel demonizing the president, trying to save the economy.
Right, because he has no answers. He has no answer for the violence. He has no leadership. While there, how many people are shot every weekend in Chicago? 30 to 50 people some weekends are shot. Record numbers of murders in Chicago. And rather than deal with those real problems, he virtue signals, which is all. This is why Hillary lost. This is why the Democrats keep losing.
By the way, do we not have that clip? Because there's a press conference. Oh, it's ready. Okay, well, let's go ahead and play that clip.
Thank you for shut up now.
Shut up.
Oh, okay. Shut up. Now, obviously, a lot of people would just slough it off and they'd say, okay, maybe I'm not cut out for this, or, you know, Alex Jones got his thing, I'm going to start my own thing or whatever it is. But this must have really, really hurt Mike Cernovich. Cernovich. I can't. Because when we watched it and laughed, I mean, it was very, 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 very funny.
We maybe did overkill. We laughed.
I mean, we laughed for days. And
it's still funny,
right? Yeah. And
it's
so
amazing how well it holds.
This
up,
got
actually
Mike Cernovich very upset, and what he did, and maybe do we have the original tweet that he? What he did was he paid, I think it was Jack Prozobiak, the guy who ended up getting caught on Bumble cheating on his pregnant wife, and then ostensibly said it was some type of mis.
There's an FBI investigation, Sam.
I don't want to say anymore because there's still an FBI investigation that's been going on for months. The FBI, very slow on this one. But he dug through my tweets, and 9 years ago, he found a tweet that I did in response to an attempt by people in the entertainment business. 100 directors or, you know, filmmakers had signed a petition saying we want Roman Polanski to be allowed back into the country to get some type of Lifetime Achievement Award because he, of course, had left on the eve of a sentencing with a plea deal for statutory rape decades ago. And I found that to be pretty offensive. The idea that you would excuse a fugitive who had been convicted of statutory rape because he's a good filmmaker. And so I fashioned a tweet. You can decide for yourself if you think it's legitimate satire, but I did. I wrote, "Don't care, Ree Polanski, but I hope if my daughter is ever raped, it's by an older, truly talented man with a great sense of mise-en-scène." Mise-en-scène, of course, is a sense of scene, an ability to shoot a good cinematic image. And so that was the joke. And then Mike Cernovich, he tweets out, he goes, "I just published MSNBC contributor Sam Cedar endorses Polanski's sex crimes in now deleted tweet." And that was a Medium post that he had done. And so so what happens is on this day, November 28th, 2017, I rush home. It was before I was aware of this, and I get off the subway, and I was rushing because it was my birthday, and I was going to the local Key Food to get some paper plates because I had a bunch of friends coming over, like three people, and we were having Chinese food to celebrate my birthday, and so I'm in the supermarket, and I get a call from MSNBC, and I think, I can't go on Hayes tonight. It's my birthday. But it turns out to be some other guy who's from, and he's like, "Do you know who Mike Cernovich is?" And I'm like, "Yeah, I do." And he goes, I should go back. As I get off the subway, I check Twitter, you know, because this is when I pull stories whenever I can. And I noticed that somebody had retweeted this tweet of mine from 9 years ago. And I thought that was weird. It was the Polanski one. And I looked at it and it was like some guy who had just like three followers and followed like 300 people. And I thought it was some type of bot or something. So I went in and I just deleted the tweet. I didn't have time to look at it. I was rushing to the supermarket. And when I get into the supermarket, I get a call. "Do you know who Mike Cernovich is?" And I'm like, "Yeah. I make fun of him on a regular basis." And the guy said, "Well, are you aware of a tweet that you made about Roman Polanski?" And I'm like, "I just saw that. Someone retweeted it." And he goes, "Yes, well, Cernovich retweeted and this and that." And that's basically started the whole thing. And so he said, and I explained it to him. I said, "This is what it was." And he said, "Let me know." And then over the course of the next week, things developed at MSNBC. And by Sunday, 4 or 5 days later, MSNBC basically spoke to a press person and said that I had been fired. I think there's some question as to whether they were trying to fire me or just let me fade away, but it all came to a head. And then Mike Cernovich was very, very happy. This is what he said.
"And we're back. Mike Cernovich, Cernovich.com. Big breaking news. Sam Cedar, who is MSNBC contributor, he is no longer an MSNBC News contributor after a tweet of him making a joke about child rape and Roman Polanski was reported by Mike Cernovich and was made publicly available. Thank you to everybody who emailed MSNBC. Thank you to all of you, your heroes. Your heroes, because you emailed MSNBC and you let them know about the tweet. You let them know the people will not, people will be heard. We are the media now. We are the media now. And if you endorse, or you can call it satire, Sam goes satire, whatever, MSNBC ain't laughing. Who's laughing now, Sam?
Everyone in this office is, I think the rest of the story is well known. After a couple of days, MSNBC reversed their decision. Mike Cernovich became very depressed and desperate. He attempted to dig himself out of a hole by getting Chuck Schumer, by smearing Chuck Schumer. And it turns out that he got sort of rat-effed. And used documents that were fake. And then we haven't heard much of Mike Cernovich. The gorilla has gone back into the cave and has been hibernating. So to answer this question, what was the question again, Matt? Could you play that?
Who's laughing now, Sam? 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 Who's laughing now, Sam?
Is this your new ringtone?
Yeah. I encourage people, go back and use that as a ringtone. And so,
not only laughing, but also growing significantly as a show.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It's been great. It was really... The whole experience, I was just explaining to Brendan, it was fun for me in a lot of different ways. I felt very confident that I had not done anything wrong. I didn't know that it would turn out so well at the beginning of it, but I enjoyed every moment of it, both professionally and personally. We introduced the Mike Cernovich Can Kiss My Ass membership, which people love. And which you can find at jointhemajorityreport.com. Just head there. So I want to wish myself a happy birthday / Mike Cernovich Day, as we call it around my house.
It's still in the background.
Who's laughing now, Sam? Who's laughing now, Sam?
All right, so...
And whenever I'm afraid that I suck at my job and everybody hates me, I'm just going to watch that clip of him on Alex Jones again.
It's so great. All right,
the
folks.
The most inconvenient part of that clip was having to explain to so many normal people who these people are just so they could enjoy that clip.
Exactly.
I relentlessly played it for like
people that
anybody
really
that was within
don't
like a...
like, yeah. Wouldn't like if yeah. you had any right. idea of what they put into the world. Right. You wouldn't like them at all. All right, folks, going to take a quick break. When we come back, Stephen Walt, author of The Hell of Good Intentions, America's Fallen Policy Elite and the Decline of U.S. Primacy. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Stephen Walt, author of The Hell of Good Intentions, America's Foreign Policy Elite and the Decline of U.S. Primacy. He is also the Robert and Renee Belford Professor of International Affairs at Harvard. Stephen, welcome to the program.
It's nice to be talking with you.
Okay, so the book basically covers more or less the last 25 years, I guess almost exactly the last 25 years, from the fall of the Soviet, shortly after the fall of the wall and the fall of the Soviet Union, the end of the Cold War. But before we get there, Just give me your assessment of broad strokes, U.S. foreign policy following World War II, just so that we have a context in which to view these last 25 years.
I would argue that the U.S. foreign policy post-World War II was mostly successful in terms of its fundamental objectives. The primary focus was, you know, the containment of the Soviet Union and promotion of what some now call a liberal world order, at least in parts of the world. And that set of goals was achieved, fortunately, without blowing up the world or without having a major great power war. It was not a perfect record by any means. The United States made a number of pretty significant blunders, of which I think the Vietnam War is probably the most obvious example. But in terms of its sort of core objectives of both defeating the Soviet Union, preserving American independence, fostering global prosperity, we were largely successful.
And just also to tease this out in terms of like what sort of the fundamental assumptions are, when we assess foreign policy, is it exclusively from the perspective of what the agenda is of when we're talking about the United States of the United States? I mean, in other words, I'm just trying to tease out, you know, sort of, I guess the notion of foreign policy realism versus other, you know, fundamental assumptions that define other perspective on foreign policy. Because, you know, some people would say, oh, we did a great job in terms of containing the Soviet Union, but maybe not so well in fostering democracy in Central America, Latin America.
Right. As I said, it was not a perfect record, and there were times where I think the United States erred in a variety of different ways. I think we exaggerated the danger that communism posed in certain contexts, so we were in some places, and Central America is a good example, I think, sort of behind the curve in promoting, democracy or human rights and things like that. I tend to think of it in sort of three categories. Foreign policy is about trying to make the American people more secure against various foreign dangers, trying to encourage American prosperity so the American people can live more, bountiful and secure lives at home. And finally, promoting a set of values that we care about, the sort of traditional values of democracy, human rights, relatively open markets, rule of law, things like that. Those are the three basic objectives, and there are sometimes trade-offs between them. But when we try to evaluate foreign policy, we sort of ask, are the American people safer? Are they more prosperous? Or are their values being accepted more widely around the world? And that's the criteria I tend to judge a foreign policy against.
Okay, great. All right, so we have a sort of a baseline as to what is the watershed, as it were, as to what we're assessing these things. So, in 1993, we're talking at the fall of the Soviet Union. Talk about the idea of liberal hegemony. I mean, what is this this notion at that time? Or I should maybe let's put it this way: what are the various competing foreign policy ideologies or perspectives that emerge from the Cold or the post-Cold War, the beginning of the post-Cold War era?
Well, what's interesting is there was hardly any debate after the Cold War ended. You know, the Soviet Union had disappeared. This is a fundamental change in world politics. The United States is now the unipolar power, really unchallenged by everyone. And the 90s are a period of great optimism. You know, we're now heading into a world where people think liberal democracy is going to spread easily, as indeed it is in Eastern Europe and in Latin America. We think peace is Middle East through the Oslo process. Iraq has been disarmed. Iran has no nuclear enrichment. Globalization has been beginning to spread. You know, Russia is adopting a market economy. And so there's this great sense that, you know, the wind is at America's back and everything's going to go smoothly. And if you look at what's going on today, it's clear that those hopes were all disappointed. Our relations with Russia and are worse than at any time since the Cold War. Democracy is now in retreat. It has been for over a decade now. Even the United States was downgraded by The Economist magazine from a full to a flawed democracy last year. The Middle East has not become more peaceful. If anything, the Middle East is more divided. And, oh, by the way, we have fought several wars, and most of them didn't turn out particularly well at great cost to the United States, which is why I think, you know, again, you would judge this record as being one of far more failures than successes. And I argue in the book that it's largely because we adopted a very ambitious strategy of trying to essentially transform the world in our image.
Was there any variance there in terms of that? Because ultimately where we ended up in terms of Iraq, keyed into the ideas that came out of the out of PNAC, right? This notion of
right.
of the United States being a hyperpower, and the was there any? All of those ideas, I mean, maybe you can characterize those ideas. And was there no divergence theoretically between, you know, the neocons and anybody else?
Actually, much less divergence than people often think. Again, it's not that there are no differences between, say, Clinton and Bush or Bush and Obama, but the continuities are at least as important as the differences. All three presidents actively supported the idea of using American power to transform other societies. Obama and Clinton, I think, did it more gently, more discreetly than Bush did with the invasion of Iraq. But the United States was formally committed to spreading democracy and using military force to do that if necessary. That's certainly the way that Obama responded in Libya. That's certainly what he did when he sent more troops to Afghanistan in 2009. And that has been a consensus view across both political parties. The mainstream Democratic foreign policy has been one of, again, sort of promoting liberal values, using American power, bringing more and more countries into American alliances. And that was also true of the sort of neocons in the Cheney era who got us into Iraq. There are some differences. I think, you know, the Democrats were more favorably disposed towards international institutions like the United Nations and others than the neocons were. But in terms of seeing the United States as the indispensable power that had to push to shape local politics in just about every corner of the world, whether by expanding NATO endlessly eastward or by intervening in other countries, it was still pushing an agenda that eventually pushed back at us in various ways.
Before we get into sort of the intentions, and maybe that's where there is, like, you know, maybe some maybe there's a little bit more disparity there, maybe there's not. But I think people have a sense of why it failed, because you know that it comes down to even basic human relations. Sometimes you can't make other people do what you want them to.
That's right. I mean, there are certainly limits to U.S. power, but again, this was an ambitious and revisionist agenda. And I would just remind everybody that, Joe Biden and Hillary Clinton and a number of other prominent members of the Obama administration voted to support the Iraq War. They were not skeptical of that particular adventure as well. So, again, this was pretty much a bipartisan consensus. I think why it failed is multiple reasons. First of all, it threatened non-democracies, including countries like China and Russia. You know, we may have had the best of intentions, but if you say that, you know, our goal is to spread democracy around the world, non-democracies are going to see that as threatening, and some of them are going to be in a position to do things to thwart us. Second, we turned out to be pretty good at regime change. We could get rid of weak foreign governments, but we had no idea what to do with those societies after we broke them. Of, unfortunately, Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, to some degree Syria, certainly Yemen as well. This was, I think, delusional to think that we could create democracies in places that were very unpromising, and certainly to believe that we could do it quickly made no sense at all. finally, globalization was, of course, all part of this. We were going to expand global markets, and I think that's a good thing. I'm in favor of free trade, but it did not deliver the benefits that were promised. Those benefits were not distributed widely with our society. So, you know, the Asian middle class did very well. Asian lower classes did well. The 1% here in the United States did pretty well. But the lower and middle classes in the United States and also in Western Europe did not really benefit from this. And that's part of the backlash, I think, that you're seeing now with populism in Europe and here in the United States.
And so the goal of spreading democracy, which I guess would align with, on some level, I mean, theoretically, right? We're looking at the sort of we're trying to take a non-jaundiced eye towards this, but to the idea of promoting a set of values. I mean, just fundamentally having that goal, which you mentioned as the third sort of tenet, I guess, of how you would assess U.S. foreign policy. That goal in and of itself was problematic, or was it really just more the tactics used to follow that strategy?
Well, certainly it's the tactics. I think liberal values are excellent values, and I'm really thrilled to live in a society where they are still reasonably well established. Some questions about how much they may be at risk today,
right,
here, even in the United States. But I'm glad that I live in a society where, you know, freedom of speech is protected and there is a functioning legal system and we have representative government. But it turns out it's not a great export commodity. The process of building democracy, even in the West, took centuries and was very contentious. And it's very difficult for outsiders to come into societies that they don't know particularly well, that have their own deep divisions, where any form of regime may create winners and losers, and the losers are going to be resentful and may resist violently. The idea that we could do that kind of social engineering quickly, again, I think was fanciful. So it is largely the tactics. We should, of course, adhere to those values and respect those values, and I think the best way to spread them abroad is mostly to create a society here in the United States that is so impressive and so admirable that others will see it and want something like that. So we can stick to our values, but the best way to spread them is by setting a good example here at home.
All right, and I want to circle back to that and maybe expand on that question. But let's move to the what you call the blob. This is the foreign policy community. I know maybe on some level, you know, it is now conflated, or maybe properly or improperly, with the deep state on some level. But there is clearly a foreign policy establishment. Tell us, characterize them for us.
Yeah. Well, these are people who devote their careers to working on matters of foreign affairs. And so you could include me as, I guess, probably a dissident member of this. By the way, just for the record, the term the blob was coined by Ben Rhodes, who was Barack Obama's deputy national security advisor and speechwriter. And he used it to refer to essentially the Washington, you know, beltway establishment on foreign policy. So I'd include, you know, the institutions of government, state, defense, intelligence, in Washington, who work on foreign affairs, lobbying groups of all kinds, whether it's human rights or arms control or defense spending or whatever, that lobby on foreign affairs issues. Those people in the media who cover foreign affairs, so they're part of this community as well. And, of course, people like me in academia who also study these issues. And the thing I'd say about it is twofold. One, it is a community, particularly at the higher levels. You know, people know each other. They've worked in various capacities or for different organizations. And success in that world depends almost entirely on one's reputation. There's no formal degree you have to have, no license you have to pass, no bar exam to practice foreign policy. You just have to be respected by others in the field who will point you to key positions or listen to what you have to say. And that creates a very powerful incentive for conformity. You don't want to do or say anything that makes you look suspect or suggests that your judgment isn't sound or whatever. So one of the central themes of the book is that there's been remarkable conformity across Democratic and Republican elites here, and surprisingly little change in what the foreign policy elite wants to do, despite the fact that for the past 25 years, many of their major projects have gone very badly. And it really wasn't until Donald Trump showed up that you had someone openly and aggressively challenging that elite. I say that, by the way, as someone who thinks Trump has only made things worse. But back in 2016, when he ran for president, one of his targets was this elite, and he said, you know, U.S. foreign, he was probably more right than wrong.
I would agree with at least, you know, with that assessment. It was sort of fun to watch him criticize Jeb Bush for his brother's work in Iraq. So, I mean, how does this, the continuity through the years, it's simply just, I mean, I guess it's blob nature. And this dynamic is not, I mean, we find this dynamic in nature, right? I mean, in nature and in academia and in other, this idea of, you know, look around and see what others are saying and sort of like a slightly conform to that. Your assessment of the blob is that they are well-intentioned, but and not necessarily as, I guess, the reasons why they pursue this strategy is a well-intentioned, I guess, temerity as opposed to, you know, maybe, or is it possible there are people like Dick Cheney who are like, well, I slightly define U.S. interests in a slightly different way, right? Just break that down for me.
Yeah, I don't think everyone in the foreign policy elite is a saint, right? But I do think, I tend not to believe the sort of worst conspiracy theories that the United States has some really nefarious objectives in all of these things. I think the vast majority of people in the foreign policy establishment believe in what they're doing. They believe that for the United States to be the world leader, the dominant world power, to be spreading its values actively in other places, to be pulling more countries into U.S.-led alliances, which then creates an obligation for the United States to protect those countries, is a good thing to do. So I think that their intentions are, for the most part, benevolent. The problem is that the results have not been the ones that they've promised, have not been the ones that they claim to produce. So if one of these goals was to spread a set of liberal values, and by liberal I don't mean left wing, I mean sort of classic principles of liberalism, of, you know, rule of law, representative government, freedom of speech, things like that, spreading those around the world they believed was going to be a good thing. But if that was what they were going to bring us, that's not what we're getting. We're actually getting a world where freedom is declining as measured by Freedom House, where the number of democracies is shrinking, and where some democracies like Hungary or Poland are sort of veering back in an illiberal direction. And we even have some concerns here in the United States about the robustness of the set of values we've all come to revere. So again, their intentions, I think, were positive, but the results were disappointing.
And why is there no accountability? I mean, I know that you were instrumental in, or at least at the very least, involved in placing that big ad in the run-up to the Iraq War. To the extent that I became more politically active, it was in those months leading up to the Iraq War, you know, the information was there. I distinctly remember, you know, telling my dad, "This is not going to be as easy as they say it is." That's just on page one. But if you read page 14 of the paper, they start telling you this is going to cost, you know, maybe a couple of $1 trillion. That this is going to be intractable. There is no weapons of mass destruction. I mean, the information was there for someone who was, you know, slightly less casual than a completely casual bystander. And yet all of these people who sold the war to us, it seems to me, suffered less than no consequences.
Yeah, I think this has been a big problem, and it's not unique to the foreign policy community.
Right.
It's true of lots of other organizations. It's hard to hold people accountable. I mean, just to take another example, look at the scandals in the Catholic Church, where people were constantly forgiven for really heinous actions as well, and you could multiply other examples too. But certainly the experience of the last 25 years is exactly what you suggest. It's a record time and time again of people not being held responsible. Look at the 9/11 Commission report, which did an interesting job of dissecting what happened, but didn't hold anyone personally accountable. No one actually made a mistake. No one is named in that report as having done something wrong. You consider most of the architects of the Iraq War have retained positions of respect and responsibility throughout. Figured just the most obvious example, the current U.S. National Security Advisor, John Bolton, was an open advocate of the Iraq War and defended it for years after as having been the correct response. You would think if we held people accountable for bad judgment, he would be a marginal figure who we kind of regarded with a certain amount of disdain. But instead, he has served in multiple administrations. Working in a very influential position in this one as well. And I could multiply more examples. What's even more greater concern is that some of the people who have gone public with reservations, I talk about several examples in the book, end up being marginal figures, right? As soon as you go outside the consensus, the likelihood that you'll get ignored or not get advanced goes up. And that's, I think, unfortunate if you want to try and learn from experience, reward the people who have been right in the past and pay maybe less attention to the people who have been consistently wrong.
How do we, I mean, you talk about how not to fix U.S. foreign policy, but just zeroing in for a moment, and I want to get to that, but zeroing in on that notion of accountability, how do we fix that? I mean, because that to me seems to be a universal problem. I mean, you mentioned like the Catholic Church, no one's held accountable or, not nearly enough. But that's theoretically a lot less a democratic institution than the U.S. government. And but I guess the foreign policy, but this is also the case. I mean, frankly, it's the same thing with pundits. Right. Like, with all due respect, I get on the TV and I sometimes have to. Be in the same building as Bill Kristol, who it seems to me couldn't have been any more wrong. I had the opportunity to sit across Tom Friedman and say, suck on this to him on TV. And that was one of the greatest moments of my life. But he still is considered to have a notion of what he's talking about. And I mean, what do we deal with the accountability issue rather than just simply saying, hey, people should be more accountable?
Well, I wish I had a magic button solution to this one, but there really isn't one. I think the only thing one can do is try to publicize these things and make them hold people publicly accountable by raising the issue, by not just going along and saying, well, he or she is a respected member of the elite. They've got lots of experience. I will treat them with great deference and respect. I may be willing to do that, but only if their record justifies it. So it does involve, the willingness to sort of confront what people's actual record looks like. This is a tricky problem, however, because, of course, foreign policy is difficult and challenging, and nobody gets everything right. None of us are infallible, and any public official is going to make some mistakes, particularly if they're in positions of responsibility. Then I think the thing we have to look for is, are people willing to acknowledge mistakes and acknowledge that they've learned from them, or do they keep defending things that clearly did not turn out well and don't appear to be learning at all and can appear to be continually recommending the same sort of policies that have failed over and over and over again. So you wouldn't rehire a baseball team's manager if they presided over 10 losing seasons and insisted everything was fine. You'd fire them and get somebody else to do it. Seems to me if there's a consistent record of failure and a sort of stubborn unwillingness to learn from one's past mistakes, then we ought to be looking for other people to do the jobs.
I agree. Sadly, we don't have an owner right? I mean, that's the that's the dilemma. But let me just transition into what we should be doing, because I wonder, you know, the structure of the way that we have been approaching foreign policy, is that something that we need to change to minimize the damage that being wrong can do?
Yeah. I think that sort of the long term, I mean, there are some forces at work in the world today that I think are going to shift the United States to a somewhat less interventionist posture. I think we're going to find ourselves more focused on China, which is going to leave less opportunity to go get into trouble in other parts of the world. I think there are pressing demands we have here at home. I think adapting to climate change is going to be very expensive, and that's going to put limits on the projects we get involved in distant areas. But I think you're also going to have to see the emergence of what you might call a new foreign policy elite, or at least a more diverse, intellectually diverse foreign policy elite. You know, for the past 25 years, as I've suggested, we had a pretty uniform mindset, you know, not 100% agreement on every single issue, but a very powerful consensus in favor of ambitious American global leadership. And I think if we get a broader community of people debating these issues, more people within it who have a skeptical view of some of these projects, we're going to end up with more intelligent policies, and we're going to be less likely to make real missteps. Building that more diverse community is going to take a while. I think millennials have a different attitude. Some of them are moving into the political scene now. The composition of Congress is changing in some interesting ways as well. But it's not going to be something that changes overnight.
And so and you advocate an outsourcing of sorts. Explain that.
Well, I believe that at least one part of outsourcing is that the United States should be devolving responsibility in some parts of the world to other countries, particularly in Europe, where the United States really does not need to play a large security role there any longer. Russia is not the Soviet Union. The Russian economy is now smaller, measured in terms of GNP, than that of Italy. Right? It's not going to take over Europe. Europe, in fact, spends more on defense every year, Europe combined, than Russia does. So the United States doesn't need to do very much there. We shouldn't be doing very much in the Middle East either, because almost everything we do there makes things worse. And we should be focusing most of our attention on Asia, where there is a rising power that may be challenging U.S. interests in a variety of ways.
And so does that involve cutting our military budget? I mean, how does that work? I mean, is there how do we actually make that happen?
I think it's partly by building a more diverse national security and foreign policy community that doesn't just subscribe to the prevailing sort of mainstream consensus, and providing, you know, creating new think tanks, new organizations that can work in Washington to shape congressional opinion, and can also be available to fill key positions in administrations that are going to be elected down the road. This is something of a generational challenge, and one of the reasons I wrote my book was to try and accelerate that process. So instead of taking 30 years, maybe it only takes 20. You also could see some interesting coalitions emerging politically. There is, I think, on foreign policy, a potential coalition between what I would call real progressives and realists like me, and also some libertarians. These three groups don't agree on everything, and there's lots of disagreements on aspects of domestic policy within those different groups. But on foreign policy, they all tend to favor a rather non-interventionist approach. And that
we're seeing that today in the Senate, right? I mean, we're seeing that today on this vote on Yemen.
That's exactly right. And, you know, it took a while to reach a rather obvious conclusion, because the Senate does not always move with great swiftness. But I think that is exactly the sort of thing you may see more of in the future.
All right. Lastly, let me just ask you about the intervention. I've read where you've expressed that you think that it is appropriate for U.S. intervention to stop a potential genocide. So how do you make that assessment? I mean, in my mind, that is why I was supportive, at least, of what the initial UN mandate was in Libya. because theoretically that is what it was supposedly about. And how do we make that assessment if we don't outsource that assessment to, you know, some type of theoretically third party?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I certainly don't rule out the use of American power to prevent a genocide, but I set a fairly high bar for such actions. First of all, one has to be really confident that that's what one's really facing. And there is a debate even now about just how serious Gaddafi's threat to the citizens of Benghazi was. There were some concerns that there was going to be a bloodbath. There was no certainty that that is the case. But the more certain you are that there's really going to be a mass killing or loss of life, obviously the greater the incentive to try and do something to prevent it. So one, you have to be really convinced something horrible is about to happen. Second, you have to be convinced that you do have the means to prevent it. And at an acceptable cost to the American people. One hates to be sort of so cost-benefit related, but that's, I think, relevant. And then finally, and very importantly, you also have to believe that you're not going to make things worse. And, for example, there is a legitimate debate to be had on U.S. policy towards Syria, where an awful humanitarian tragedy has taken place. But it seems to me the judgment of the Obama administration, and especially President Obama, was that for the United States to get more actively involved, or in particular to go in and try and take down the Assad regime, was actually going to make things worse. Was going to create a failed state and ultimately possibly opportunities for extremist groups to gain power there as well. Now, he may have been wrong, but it seems to me that's the way you have to think about it. Is there a real danger? Is there something we can do about it at an acceptable cost? And are we confident that we're not going to make things worse?
I guess the question is, how do you get, those are tough questions.
Yeah, these are judgment. Well, they are judgment calls, and reasonable people are sometimes going to disagree about how to answer them. But those are the questions you have to ask, it seems to me, as opposed to sort of reflexively saying, oh, well, something bad is happening someplace. It's our responsibility to go stop it. And you just also want to be aware that there is a slippery slope here, that the more you welcome moral crusades of this kind, the more likely you are to suddenly discover you're back in the business of trying to govern countries that you really don't understand very well.
Stephen Walt, the book is The Hell of Good Intentions, Americans, Foreign Policy Elite, and the Decline of U.S. Primacy. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
It was really great talking with you, too.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
All right, folks. Oh, everybody's got a cold around here. We're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half of the program. He had to go teach class. Could have kept him on for another 20 minutes, I think. But got to get to class. Students are waiting. Just a reminder, this program relies on you, our listeners, for 98% of its revenue, 96.5. I don't know what the latest numbers are. You can support this program and tell Mike Cernovich again to kiss his ass, or kiss your ass.
His own ass.
Kiss his own ass. Kiss any ass he wants to by heading over to jointhemajorityreport.com. I want to thank all of you who have become members, and I want to thank Mike Cernovich for the fun that the last year. I think every year on the 28th, I'm going to celebrate because of Mike Cernovich.
Becoming delayed now where our time is becoming delayed now where I always ask people, how long ago was it when Kathy Griffin pulled her little ISIS beheading stunt? How long ago was Scaramucci fired? Everything is happening.
Seems like 1,000 years ago.
Yeah, exactly. So our time is becoming delayed because we're approaching the singularity. Whatever that means, we don't know yet because we've never been
noticed.
In the singularity.
Hold on, wait a second. Go back. I never noticed when Alex Jones, he was with him with the delayed, but then when he got to the singularity, Alex Jones did that same thing where he looks up, his eyes just roll back into his head. Watch this.
everything is happening.
Seems like a thousand years ago.
Yeah, exactly. So our time is becoming dilated because we're approaching the singularity. Whatever that means, we don't know yet because we've never been in the singularity. But our time now is being accelerated, right? Where a second feels like
whatever that means,
a minute, right? We live so much in a day now. A full day now feels like a month, and a month feels like a year, and a year feels like a decade. I mean, think about it. We hadn't even met. Feels like I knew you 10 years, 20 years. We met, like, what, for the first time a few months ago?
Agree.
It's crazy, right?
So this guy's crazy. It feels like it's been a long time. Every second.
I have to say, honestly, time undilated for me, Mike Cernovich. I feel like this, it was just 3 weeks ago that that you were providing for me one of the more dynamic, dramatic, exciting weeks that I have had in a long time. It used to be, my life used to be a lot more dynamic, you know, but then you get kids, right. Settle down, you show up to work every day, most days, and then things slow down. So you can support this program. By going to jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, folks, you got to hustle. I am not kidding now. Tickets are, we've just been back for 2 days since Thanksgiving break, and tickets are selling like hotcakes to the Brooklyn Podfest Live Majority Report show on January 13th at 2:30 p.m., 18 and over. The whole gang's going to be here, and I'm debating about a guest or who it should be or what kind of guest. So we'll see about that. But nevertheless, we'll be there with bells on, and
bells on.
Do you say in the festive season? Okay, so sure. Go to majority.fm.
We really are stoked about.
I'm doing
this
the Elvis Jones face.
You can pick it.
What? What? Okay. Anyway, great. Matt, do we have that clip? Great. Here's that clip.
You can head to majority.fm to buy your tickets or the show is going to be at the Bell House in Brooklyn. And it's a decent sized venue, but we're getting close to there not being any tickets.
It won't be the first time we sell that baby out.
It's true. It would be the second time.
Yeah, but this time stay for the following act.
That's right.
That was awkward.
I think they're doing it different this time.
Okay,
that was a different festival. That was the New York Podfest. Oh. This is the Brooklyn Podfest.
Oh, whoa. Brooklyn.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What a diverse marketplace.
Exactly. We're almost like 1.4 miles away from that place.
Right.
So check it out. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Jamie brought us back some Zapatista coffee. That is where Just Coffee started. That fair trade. That's why they've got that same star on their thing. And
it's pretty cool.
I'm drinking a little bit right now. It's good.
Thanks, Jamie.
It smelled good.
It smelled
great.
You're welcome.
I bought it right from the Zapatistas.
There you go. Now you can't all do that, but you can go to justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Today is Wednesday. It is Mike Cernovich Day, and which means that yesterday, when Mike Cernovich Day falls on a Wednesday, that means the day before it was a Tuesday. And
I was reminiscing with the bit that we did on TMBS the week after it all just went really badly for Mike was a Mandela radio show where he was just like, we don't know Weird Mike. He's weird.
He got overextended.
Weird Mike. I mean, he's weird. Professor Richard Wolf was on yesterday. We had an incredible time.
In studio,
Corbin, Brexit. I mean, really just a masterclass in both the main and post game.
You can watch Griscom deliver his economic minute as Wolf sort of lounges in the background.
Wolf lounges in the couch, staring over his shoulder.
Was there a battle?
It was actually...
Of wits.
It was definitely a battle of wits, and we played the Goodfellas clip for Wolf as well. The beginning, focusing on Northern Ireland and South Africa and Brexit, and... Also, tickets are moving fast, like a empty potato bag for the February 1st live show, at also at the Bell House, not part of Brooklyn Podfest, just TMBS. Get your tickets for that too, and patreon.com/TMBS for everything.
We should get some, maybe some like swag that if you go to both shows, like somehow you get a tick, like a, we should work out something like that. Like you get like a coupon, and if you match it, that's like torn. And if you match it at the second show, you get like, together, yeah. Right? Yeah, Jamie, what's happening on the Antifada?
Oh, who knows, man? I've.
All right.
I just got back from Mexico. I'm still so tired. No, there are things happening.
You guys got to take a nap. I don't know what's going on at that house.
We're doing our best. We had a chill night last night, but anyway,
tough stuff.
We got we still have our episode out on the history of the IWW that Sean did with Jake and Alex from Pod Damn America. That is a crossover episode, folks. This weekend we are having on a Marxist professor of our own named Paul Maddock Jr. to destroy neoclassical economics with facts and logic. So that should be interesting for anyone who wants to know more about Marxist economics, aka the kind that actually make sense. And then the following week, a little preview for you, we're definitely going to put together an episode on the Zapatista uprising in Mexico.
All right. And Matt? Literary Hangover. It's my podcast. It's available where podcasts are. And the most recent episode will be uploaded for the people who like to watch it on YouTube shortly.
No, forget it. Fine.
What?
No, I was just going to say that now all of the TMBSs are on our YouTube channel, just so people, in case they're looking for it.
Oh, the live show.
The live show, yeah.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. The IM machine is on. We will call into the show and see you in the fun half.